not a toy. Fill up this here paper cup and give it to the nurse.
Hello, this is the Doctor's Inn, and I'm Ken Logan. Hey, before I start the show, I'm going to give you an update on the Dixie Fire. Apparently, that's in Plumas County. It's currently burning northeast towards Tobin Ridge. You could visit Plumas County Sheriff's Office Facebook page for further information. The fire is approximately 2,250 acres currently, 0% contained. It's steep and inaccessible terrain and making containment difficult. There's an evacuation warning for Pulga and Northeast Concow. And the road closure so far is Camp Creek Road is closed. Okay. Welcome to the Doctor's Inn. I'm Ken Logan. I'm a family practice doctor here in Chico. And I do the Doctor's Inn the third Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 in the evening. And I like to discuss health and medical issues that I think are important for us to be on the same page relative to. I'm interested in hearing from you if there's something you would like me to cover on the show, and you could contact me by email about that. And my email address is K, that's the letter K, K Logan, L-O-G-A-N. So K Logan M-D at yahoo.com. You need to know that the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. And speaking of underwriters, the Doctor's Inn is made possible by you, the generous contributions from you, the KZFR supporters, and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or to have your event listed, visit friendsofthearts.net. And by Dahlmeyer Insurance Agency, an independent agent and retail broker since 1948. Dahlmeyer Insurance provides a range of coverage options, from home and auto insurance to farm and ranch coverage. You can reach Dahlmeyer Insurance in Chico at 342-6421 and in Orville at 533-3424 or at chicoinsurance.com. Okay, so today's show, again, I gave you a little brief introduction there. I'm going to talk about Cuba and healthcare there. I'm going to give you a little bit of background on the country's situation prior to that. I'm going to talk about the needle exchange and talk about COVID and stuff like that. But let's start with Cuba. Okay, Cuba has been, of course, in the news. You may know this. It's been in the news lately because there's some protesting occurring there in the streets and against the government. And actually, that's mainly about adequacy of food being at a deficit, apparently, especially during this time of the COVID pandemic. If you're wanting to hear the inside story on the protests there, I'm going to tell you a place you can hear about that with accuracy about what's happening. And that is, if you pull up Democracy Now! From yesterday, the show Democracy Now!, which actually plays on this station every weekday at 8 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock in the morning. But yesterday's program, so Wednesday the 14th of July, Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez interviewed a Cuban who is in Havana, Cuba, the main city there, who is a reporter and journalist. And he's a journalist for a media outlet called The Daily Beast. I'm telling you, that is an excellent source of what's going on and has been going on over there. So that's the Democracy Now! Show. That's yesterday's show. If you can look that up, you're going to get some inside information. So Cuba has been a subject of interest to me over the years, although I haven't personally learned much relative to specifics relating to Cuba's social or health situations. I've heard bits of it, but not specifics. It's my opinion that our information here in the U.S. about life there in Cuba, including healthcare, has been real limited over the last several years. And furthermore, it seems odd to me how we in the United States deal with Cuba. Anyway, it seems odd to me. So I remember back in the days of their social revolution around 1959, 1960, only because of the limited news and opinions that we received here in our media. So what went on was, in 1959, they essentially ousted a capitalism system and entered in a system of socialism. And here in the United States, if you say the word socialism, it just, you know, as I've grown up, it seems to me the opinion of the word socialism in the United States just sets people into thinking, oh, evil, oh my God, how could those, it must be so bad for those people. And that's it, end of story, no real information about it. And that's a bias. This bias being pervasive in the meager amount of information that we have had in the U.S. about the goings-on in Cuba. That bias and that stigma given to us has seemed to be odd to me, why we do that. Anyway, today on The Doctor's Inn, I'm going to give you some information about the facts of how people are living in Cuba, specifically from a healthcare point of view, because it's a big deal. It's an amazing deal. It's my opinion that we here in this country, the U.S., need to know that, look at that, and maybe look at our system and compare it. Anyway, first let's open our eyes and look back at their social political history in Cuba. Let's look at it in a non-biased way. Let's just look at the facts. So in 1959, they were living in a capitalistic society, a money-based society, where those who were the elite were living well, and those in poverty, which was the majority, were, well, they were in poverty and neglected by the government. That's the way it was. Money did the talking. In 1959, there was a change of government, what they call a revolution. Their president, Fulgencio Batista, was forced out, and Fidel Castro became the president. And as far as the information we've got, that was the end of the story. We didn't have ongoing communication with them after that. The U.S. seemed to respond, in my opinion, the U.S. seemed to respond to that change of government like a spoiled child, rejecting Cuba and its citizens, its people, with our government reacting, I'm saying this as my opinion, in an elitist kind of colonialistic kind of way, a rejection. And my opinion over the years has been that the U.S. has been wrong in that rejection of that country. Our response to that country, it's been so unusual to me. We don't do that to other countries. We have good State Department relationships, and et cetera, and trade, et cetera, with other countries such as China and Russia. We do a lot of trade with China. So, but not Cuba. We simply closed the doors. We haven't, the U.S. responded as if we were in charge of Cuba as a country, as a people, and now they are in charge of themselves. Oh my gosh, how could that be? How could Cubans be in charge of Cuba? Well, they are in charge of Cuba. Our response, however, was and still is to blockade them physically with relative to trade. And not just until we could calm down and see the reality of it, but an ongoing blockade and sanctions. We've sanctioned them and blockaded them for the last 60 years, you know, with the idea of how dare Cuba make choices for itself. Well, the outcome of this draconian reaction to our neighbor has been to try our best to starve them out to do our best to worsen the lives of the people there. The people, for God's sakes. It's unbelievable to me. So when our Secretary of State and our President, President Biden, who I otherwise am very happy with, come on to national television and radio and say that they, as our leaders, are on the side of the Cuban, when they look at these protests, that they're on the side of the Cuban people and we wish for their well-being and their rights, while at the same time we continue this ongoing stranglehold around the neck of every single Cuban citizen relative to inhibiting their access to food and other goods and medicines, raw materials for manufacture of items, including medicines and vaccines, this ongoing stranglehold around the necks of every person in Cuba for 60 years. It's so unbelievable. Our leaders are talking out of both sides of their mouths, you know, talking about caring about the people with this elephant in the room right over their shoulder about how they're continuing this stranglehold on those people. It's un-American. Anyway, that's my common sense view of this scenario. And on this show, The Doctor's In, I'm going to talk about the health and medical issues in Cuba. Our hands remaining in action on the stranglehold on the necks of the citizens, and that includes, because this is a health and medical show, well, that includes the health and well-being of those people. So that's why I'm talking about it on this show. Our stranglehold on them includes inhibiting adequate health and well-being, I'm telling you. As an American physician, I'm absolutely not proud. Anyway, so now, after me laying out that piece of information and opinion about our role in Cuba's situation, I'm going to now put on a different hat, my doctor hat, my regular doctor hat, and actually talk about some positive information about Cuba. And that has to do with how the Cuban people have dealt with their health care in their country. And it is amazing. I hope you, the listeners, will listen to this because it is remarkable. And we should look at it in comparison to what's happening in our country. So the information that I got on healthcare in that country is from an article in one of our journals, the American Journal. It's in a journal called the American Journal of Public Health from the American Public Health Association. Now, it turns out this article I looked up is from August 2012, and it's written by an American physician named William Keck, C. William Keck, M.D., and MPH. In other words, he's a physician, but he also has his master's in public health. He's the former director of health for the city of Akron, Ohio, and he also is a professor emeritus in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Northeast Ohio Medical University in Akron, Ohio. Also participating in the writing of the article is a woman named Gail Reed, and she also has a master's degree. She is the executive editor of a journal called Medic Review and the international director of something called Medical Education Cooperation with Cuba at Havana, Cuba. So she has specific data on healthcare there and the healthcare outcomes there. And their article is called The Curious Case of Cuba. So if you want to look that up, it's August 2012. In the American Journal of Public Health, and the article is called The Curious Case of Cuba. Okay, so looking at the healthcare in Cuba, the things I'm going to lay out for you, first it's going to have to do with the process that they have undertaken over the past 60 years and are still doing. And then we're going to look at some of the specific health outcomes from that. And also we're going to be thinking about our country. I'm going to be thinking about our country and what our health care system looks like and what our outcomes are, how our outcomes, health outcomes compare in a couple things. There's, of course, some stark differences in all of this when we compare the countries. And the differences are for some obvious reasons. And here's the obvious reason, the main obvious reason. And that is money. And the fact that in the United States, money and profit relative to health care, being the thing we pray to in this country. It's sacrosanct in this country. As opposed to the actual health care action, which is done in Cuba, it's a stark difference. And it's embarrassing to me about our country, comparatively. Remember, Cuba changed from a capitalistic society to a socialist society in 1959. So prior to 1959, it was capitalistic. And there was a marked stratification in healthcare availability in Cuba. Sounds a little bit like the United States does currently, doesn't it? In other words, healthcare availability was present in those days only for those people with money. And that involved healthcare presence essentially only in the biggest city, Havana. But it was healthcare was dramatically lacking everywhere else in the country. Health outcome markers for the country in general, like infant mortality, etc., were not good. They were bad then. We need to also remember that the U.S. has, of course, this in a draconian fashion, this embargo now on Cuba, and has since 1959, limiting the availability of commerce for Cuba over the last 60 years. Cuba did initially receive aid from the Soviet Union for the first 10 years or so. However, the dismantling of the Soviet Union in the 1990s put that aid to a stop. So the health care in Cuba has put together over the past 50 to 60 years has been with a limited amount of resources. But at least they were limited from a financial standpoint. However, let's keep in mind that another type of resource in any country is the resource of people, fellow countrymates, the people. And I'm going to show you exactly what that meant in Cuba. So, in a stepwise fashion, starting in 1959, Cuba developed a socialized universal healthcare system. And here's some important points I want you to hear. They developed this healthcare system of theirs under a set of specific principles. They're so ingrained as principles of their healthcare system, they're actually enumerated in their constitution since 1976. So these principles of their healthcare system are enumerated in their constitution. And check out these principles. First, in Cuba, healthcare is a right available to all people equally and free of charge. Next, the assurance, not insurance, but assurance of health care for all the people is a responsibility of the federal government to assure that health care goes to everybody. Next, preventative and curative services are integrated, meaning that preventative care is an integral part of the function of their healthcare system. Next, public participation is present in the system of healthcare, in the development and functioning of it. It's not insurance companies, it's not bureaucrats, it's all people. It's the public participates in this. Everybody does. It's a united front of relative to everybody's healthcare, which is a great idea. Anyway, next, healthcare activities are integrated with economic and social development, with these economic and social factors also being integrated into this healthcare system function. You'll hear a little bit more about that in a minute. And finally, global health cooperation is a fundamental obligation of the healthcare system and its professionals. So they're not blind to the needs of other countries in the world, and they participate in helping the needs of other countries, especially those that are third world countries. Cuba started out with a goal of extending healthcare services. Remember, the people other than in Havana were healthcareless. So they began by training additional healthcare professionals and putting them to work under a unified healthcare system that they called Rural Medical Service, and supplying these physicians and other healthcare professionals, including nurses, into the rural areas of the country where healthcare access had been significantly lacking. Remember that their system is a universal health system, and specifically in their case, a socialist system. Therefore, all these healthcare workers are employees of the federal government. This also included building hospitals in the rural parts of the country. Originally, in 1959, get this, there was only one, yes, one hospital outside of the city of Havana. For the whole country, all the hospitals were in Havana. There was only one outside of that. And within the first 10 years of this rural medical service program, after the first 10 years, there were now 53 rural hospitals built and supplied. These practitioners in these rural areas began the melding together of public health and what we call clinical medicine. In other words, they melded public health and preventative care with the other care of ongoing care of existing diseases. They melded this stuff, these two approaches together. And that included and does include teaching not only more healthcare providers and nurses, but also teaching the people. Teaching the people in all the communities about health practices and prevention and cleanliness and water cleanliness, etc. And relative to prevention of infectious diseases such as malaria, which they had a dramatic impact on, and also HIV, which was dramatically lacking then. Help with HIV was dramatically lacking then initially. So the training of healthcare professionals, both doctors and nurses, began changing then under the responsibility of a newly established entity at that point called the Ministry of Public Health. The education for these was free, with only the only prerequisite being academic achievement, not money. So the medical school training and later the nursing school training was integrated with these rural communities. In other words, a lot of their training apparently is done in these rural communities. And many of those people, therefore, stay in those rural communities to practice, doctors and nurses. And within the first few years of these changes, the health problems of the country began improving significantly, such as improvement in things such as infant mortality. They're actually currently have a lower infant mortality than we do in the United States. I'm going to say that again. Cuba has a lower infant mortality rate than we do in the United States of America. And likewise, helping the incidence of low birth weight babies. They currently have a lower rate of low birth weight babies in Cuba than we do in the United States of America. Their life expectancy improved. It now equals ours. And deaths from infectious diseases, including AIDS and malaria, was improved. Actually, included in this was improving clean drinking water situation for people. So remember that their healthcare focus includes social, cultural, and environmental elements of the people's lives, not just, here, take this medicine. Okay. However, in the beginning, there were still access problems, and there were still long waits to see doctors, and there was coordination of care problems. So in 1974, so about 14 years after beginning this, Cuba established a model of care that is renowned in the world. And it's called a community-based polyclinics throughout the entire country. And these, I know that sounds like a little silly word, polyclinics, but it's impressive. Because the clinics that were set up throughout the country are kind of the hubs in the whole country, each section of the whole country. These clinics are the hubs of care in their area of the country. These are essentially locally established clinics throughout the entire country, not leaving any areas of the country unserved, and are serving the specific needs of each specific community, and is made up of distinct types of healthcare providers. For sure, it includes at least one general medical doctor, a pediatrician, an OBGYN doctor, and there will probably be several of them, but they're the backbone of each of these clinics includes a general doctor, a pediatrician, and an OBGYN doctor. And some of them have dental care as well. So this community-based healthcare model of training and practice includes the learning about the localized medical needs, but also about the economic and social needs of the community there, and working together with the people even that are in local governance positions. These are truly community-based projects and functions with common shared goals and expectations. It's amazing. None of this has money-making as any element of their goals. This healthcare system functions on the merits of care and mutual caring, and not on any merit of how much money someone can make in the medical business, or how much money is needed to be made so you can pay off some school loan. The prevention of health conditions or complications is an integral part of what is taught to not only the healthcare professionals, but to the people they serve, and of what is done, and then with what is actually accomplished. And the feature and the figures relating to the healthcare outcomes accomplishments are amazing. Again, now their infant mortality rates are better than ours. The rates of occurrence of low birth weight babies is better than ours. Life expectancy is equal to ours. And healthcare is available to every single Cuban equally without a fee. When other countries of the world, maybe not the United States because we're blind, but other countries of the world, including the United Nations, has looked at this over the years. There's a organization with the United Nations called United Nations Development Program. And in the year 2000, here's two quotes from the United Nations Development Program. This, the Family Doctor and Nurse Program in Cuba, has been the most important reform carried out in the national healthcare system, and it has become the pillar of primary care. The objective of this model has been to improve the health situations of the population through comprehensive actions involving individuals, families, communities, and the environment. And then they go on to say, an evaluation of 25 countries in the Americas measuring relative inequalities in health revealed that Cuba is the country with the best situation in Latin America and the Caribbean. It is also the country that has achieved the most effective impact with resources, though scarce, invested in the health sector. So Cuba has become a model of excellence relative to the accomplishment of healthcare. And this being done over the last 50, 60 years, where it's been in a situation where Cuba's big, rich, powerful neighbor, the United States, has been doing its best to strangle the people of the country. This, again, is amazing for two reasons. First, it's amazing to me how our country has been treating the people of Cuba over the last 50, 60 years and continues to do so. And secondly, it's amazing to me how the people of Cuba practice their health care in such an amazingly impressive way. There you go. And that article, I'm going to tell you what that article is. It tells you these details. It's in the American Journal of Public Health, August 2012. The title, The Curious Case of Cuba. And we're about halfway through the show now. I tell you what, why don't we do this? Play a little song for a minute. What is this going to be? This is going to be Dear Doctor by the Rolling Stones?
Yes.
Cool.
Okay.
Dear Doctor, take one. Right.
Oh, help me, please, doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's beating. Can't you please take it out and preserve it right there in that jar. Oh, help me, please, mama, I'm sickening. It's today.
Hello again, this is Ken Logan, Dr. Ken Logan, and this is The Doctor's Inn. Remember, you're listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. And this is The Doctor's Inn. I guess I already said that. Okay, next subject I want to talk about is something, and I want to tell you that the reason I'm bringing this up now is because there's an amazing nonprofit organization now up and running in Chico that I'm going to tell you about at the end of this show. So please listen to, into this article, into this part of the show. I want to tell you about it at the end of this part of the show. So please keep listening.
Please.
Okay. So this definition of this subject, needle exchange. What the heck does a needle exchange mean? Well, It has to do with people who are addicted to drugs such as methamphetamine, heroin, and fentanyl. These particular street drugs are often used via injection. Injection mainly into veins, sometimes muscle. People using these street drugs are often become addicted. Okay, what kind of problems do these addictions cause? So I'm going to bring up I'm going to lay this out as to what the problems are with this scenario of IV drug addiction. And of course, first of all, the fact that the use of these drugs often leads that person to becoming addicted, that's the first problem to enumerate. So addiction itself is a problem. Next, overdose is a potential problem. That is, death or near death can inadvertently occur when a person injects one of these drugs, most specifically one of the opiates such as heroin and fentanyl. And I'm going to tell you, with respect to overdose, the CDC now tells us that there's been an unprecedented 29% increase in overdose deaths last year. So we've had an increase in overdose deaths in this country by 29%. That's almost 30% in this country over the last year, by the way. Hey, and by the way, this organization that's up and running, and the big thing that they're doing is safety. Safety is the issue. Decreasing harm, safety. So that's the big deal, and that's what I'm going to be talking about later in this talk on this subject. Okay, so I mentioned that addiction's a problem. Okay, overdose, maybe, if it occurs, that's a problem. Woo. Okay, third, next step of problem with drug addiction here is this IV drug addiction, IM and IV drug addiction. Well, there are certain diseases that can be passed from one person with one of these injection drug addictions to another person with one of these addictions if they share needles or syringes. These diseases can spread this way. There are diseases that can spread this way, and we call them blood-borne diseases, and they include diseases such as HIV, AIDS, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, and even hepatitis A, infectious hepatitis. They're all viral illnesses. Next, there are also bacterial infections that can occur in a person injecting these street drugs. Two bacteria-caused concerns are abscesses, that is, these balls of infection, at the injection site, and sometimes something called bacterial endocarditis can occur, which means an infection of the heart, and that's serious. Okay, well, it's all serious, but that's bad serious. Okay, the next problem with this, addiction to street drugs is a financial cost that someone who's addicted has to deal with. That is, they may have a limited income of some sort, and drug addiction eats away at that limited amount of money that person has. Therefore, things like adequate food intake can become problematic. And having enough money for a place to live can sometimes be problematic. Then, of course, there's an additional problem of the law. These are illegal drugs. So these people are always, they have that problem, dealing with law enforcement officers, of course. And lastly, and this is part of what is a big part of what the rest of this talk is about, and what there's this organization down in town helping this part, and that is that when people inject street drugs, the needle and syringe need to be disposed of in an appropriate way so that the needle and syringe is not used by anybody else, and so that the needle and syringe is not left in a place that could also become harmful to some other person in the community. There are specific ways that needles and syringes should be disposed of. No, and that happens to be no matter if the needles and syringes are because of use via street drug use, but including use of needles and syringes for medical conditions such as diabetes and insulin injections. There's correct ways of, for safety reasons, for disposing of needles and syringes. And that is to, in order to keep the community safe from bloodborne diseases. That's a reality of public health. So the proper disposal of needles and syringes, again, whether it's addiction drugs or prescription drugs, has two important steps involved. So the appropriate disposal of needles and syringes has two important steps involved. First, after they're used, the needle and syringe should be put into a container that's going to keep some other person from becoming stuck by it. And that kind of container is usually called a sharps container. They're usually red in color. They can be bought at any pharmacy without prescription. That is, if the person has money to buy that container. Secondly, second step is that this sharps container of whatever type it is needs to be properly disposed of. That is, it's not supposed to be thrown in the trash, but rather to be taken to a hazardous waste site or facility where it can be disposed of appropriately. In our community, the one that's available that I know of for sure is all the way out at the airport. And that's only on certain hours on Fridays and Saturdays. I'm not making this up. And you have to prove that you're live around Chico. You got to bring in, I don't know, a bill or some PG&E bill or something to prove you're a local. Anyway, other sources of places to put sharps containers in, so they can be disposed of correctly and not in the trash, have, you know, those other available places have been a state of flux over the last few years. But that, I'm going to tell you, that's another part of the good news of what I'm going to talk about this nonprofit organization now functioning in Chico relative to helping safety of needle exchange situation. And that includes avenue of, for everybody, anybody, for disposal, proper disposal via them. Of sharps containers. Okay. So first, I'm gonna ask this question. Sorry. For someone like me, a healthcare provider and doctor, the question is, what help is needed for a person who's addicted to an injectable street drug or drugs? First, I'm going to lay out, enumerate these steps needed to help them. I'm finally going to tell you again about that community organization, nonprofit that's helping. But here, the answer to the question about what are these steps to accomplish help, what help is needed. First, if the person is desiring to get help relative to breaking this addiction they have, therefore they're looking to get off the drug they're addicted to, then that person can be advised relative to availability of rehabilitation programs. Or at least that person could be steered to someone who knows about rehabilitation programs. And let me say to you, let me let you know, it's stark. You would hope that there would be that would be something that really is available and nicely laid out and done with greatness in our community. And it isn't. But there are rehabilitation programs that are available, and there's information out there if the person can obtain that information. Secondly, what's the second thing of help that can be done for this person who's addicted to these IV drugs? The person can be helped relative to the acquiring for them of safe and clean supplies, such as safe and clean needles and syringes. That is something that can be done. The third thing that can be done to help this person who's addicted is the availability of sharps containers can be facilitated, and the placement of the sharp containers in a place for appropriate disposal, not in the trash, can also be facilitated. And fourthly, for people who are addicted to opiates, like heroin, fentanyl, codeine, hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, the opiates, the availability of the medication for treatment of overdose, which is Narcan or naltrexone, can be made available to that people or made available to that person's friend or loved one or family. That Narcan or naltrexone is the immediate emergency treatment for anybody who's in the process of an overdose of an opiate. It can quickly reverse the opiate effect in the body. The main problem with the overdose of an opiate is that the person stops breathing, and then, of course, they'd likely die or at least come close to dying. Narcan or naltrexone, if immediately given, can reverse that. The Narcan, however, is administered by injection into muscle or is also available by nasal spray. This administration of Narcan would have to be done, of course, by someone who is there with the person who's overdosed, such as a family person, a friend, or frankly, in reality, anyone who's around and sees that there's a Narcan thing present in a person's possession. Well, shoot, they could use it on the person. Again, the other name of Narcan is naltrexone. So the availability of the antidote for overdose, Narcan or naltrexone, is the fourth thing that can be facilitated for all people who are addicted to these opiates. So those four steps, the helping steer a person to rehabilitation, the facilitating of availability of clean injection stuff, like needles and syringes, the facilitating of the proper disposal of needles and syringes into sharps containers, and then the proper disposal of the sharp containers, and finally, the supplying of Narcan or naltrexone, are now being able to be accomplished here in our community by a nonprofit organization who's been working on becoming able to do this work in our community for the past few years. They've had some legal and political hurdles to get over. But this nonprofit organization has been steady and dedicated and are finally up and running. So the program that they have now is present here in our community to help these people is free of charge, relative to help these people stay safe and helping our community stay safe. And that is called their needle exchange program. Use of this needle exchange program is free. It's free, no appointment necessary, and it occurs each Friday morning from 9 to 11 in the morning, each Friday, 9 to 11 in the morning, and the site is located in a facility essentially on the corner of Park Avenue and East 18th Street in South Chico. The program is essentially run by volunteers, and it is a remarkable program, well done and reliable. I've been there. I've seen it function. It's remarkable. It's to be proud of what these volunteers are doing. It also involves the presence of a volunteer physician, a doctor from our community. The address of this needle exchange site is 171 East 18th Street, half a block from the corner of Park Avenue and East 18th Street in South Chico. It's behind a chain link fence, and the gate into the facility is monitored by volunteers during the hours of the clinic. And the hours of that clinic, needle exchange clinic, free of charge, no appointment necessary, is Fridays, 9 to 11 each Friday morning. So, now our community has a needle exchange program. Incidentally, needle exchange programs are present in many towns and cities across this state and across this country. We, fortunately, now have ours. Again, the goal is to make the situation of injectable street drugs use more safe and to prevent harm as best possible. More safe for the person who's addicted and more safe for our community. Every Friday, 9 to 11 in the morning, no appointment necessary, 171 East 18th Street, near the corner of Park Avenue and East 18th Street. They also, by the way, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, have a metal, large metal containery thing just outside the gate. So between the chain link fence and the road, 18th Street, there's a black metal thing where any time of the day, any day of the week, a person could put their Sharps container in it, can dispose of their Sharps container in it anytime. And you don't have to be a client of the needle exchange thing. Anybody can do that, including people with diabetes. If the needles have to be in some kind of Sharps container. No free needles or syringes, please. They have to be in a Sharps container. You can put it in this thing. And this thing is such that you open this thing, put the Sharps container in, and then close it, and then the Sharps container drops into this big thing. It is not... A person is not able to reach into that. Anyway, it's very cool what this nonprofit organization is doing in our town, Chico, California, relative to making it safe, relative to the issue of needles and syringes, to be proud of. Okay, that's that subject. Got a few more minutes now, don't I? And this is the Doctor's Inn, and I'm Dr. Ken Logan, and this is KZFR 90.1 FM. That's what you're listening to. I'm glad you're listening to it, by the way. looking at articles, I noticed that the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, stated that... In the beginning of the pandemic, there was an 80% decline in breast and cervical cancer screenings. So, and the reason I brought that, I'm bringing this up, is that we all know that during the COVID pandemic, many of us put our own health stuff on hold, you know, our own healthcare on hold. And I'm just encouraging us all to get back in the swing of things. Relative to taking care of ourselves and our health. And that means eating well, eating wisely. That means getting good rest. That means staying active and getting adequate body activity regularly. That means when you need it, getting assistance from healthcare providers. And if you're on medications, to stay with your medications unless you need a change through your provider. And in the case of cancer, we doctors advise that people participate in regular screening for various cancers, because cancers are situations where if you find the cancer early, that is by screenings, and get it treated early, it can be a cure. But if you wait and you find out about your cancer late, cure is not able, generally. So breast cancer screening, cervical cancer screening, such as pap smears, that is. Prostate cancer screening via PSA blood tests. These are things that to talk to your healthcare providers about and have regularly done And the breast cancer involves mammograms for those of a certain age, et cetera. So talking with your healthcare provider about cancer screenings and staying updated on that is important. COVID. Have you all heard about a virus named COVID-19? I bet you have. And in our area, as of yesterday, July 14th, there were 8 COVID patients in the hospital, in Inlow Hospital. There were 8 patients yesterday. That's slightly more than the past few weeks. And 2 of those happened to be on mechanical ventilation, in other words, a breathing machine. And that's another change. That's we haven't had cases, to my knowledge, on ventilators, mechanical breathing things, for quite a while. So there's been an uptick a bit. And as we all know, there's been an uptick again in cases, the frequency of cases lately. And that probably or possibly has to do with the Delta variant, which is more contagious and a bit more severe. For instance, in Butte County, for the past week, we have a few more cases. There were 65 new cases identified in Butte County of COVID last week for the week. And that's up from 43 the prior week. So a little uptick. Speaking of upticks, the issue of in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine relative to Guillain-Barré syndrome, that's just a question mark at this point. And if there is an uptick in Guillain-Barré presence in people who have received the Johnson & Johnson, it's going to be a very slight uptick. It's going to be a rarity. Let me tell you that Guillain-Barré syndrome is a neurologic autoimmune thing where the body makes the immune system turns against its own neurologic system, both brain and other nerves, and numbness, tingling, difficulty movement of certain parts of the body, sometimes lungs, breathing apparatus is at a disadvantage with that. But normally there's 3,000 to 6,000 people in the United States every year who have Guillain-Barré syndrome, unrelated to COVID. This is prior to COVID and doesn't have anything to do with COVID. It has to do with God knows what, but sometimes other infections, actually, including a bacteria called Campylobacter gut virus, bacteria thing, and even some flu cases and even flu vaccine. In the 70s, with the swine flu vaccine, there was a little uptick in Guillain-Barré as well, which I actually saw a couple of cases of back then as a corpsman in the Navy. But I want you to know that these are rare cases, this uptick relative to the Johnson & Johnson. It's a rarity. I mean, there's this underlying level of numbers of Guillain-Barré syndrome in the community and this little bitty blip up with in people with Johnson & Johnson. So we got to see what comes out of that the evaluation that the CDC is doing on that. So keep your eyes open. But my advice is don't be afraid. The bad uptick is the COVID. There's a 40-some-odd-year-old friend of mine who's now in the hospital fighting for her life. She's actually out of the hospital now and back at home. But God dang, it was touch and go with this lady. What's up with that? You know, I mean, and she was unvaccinated. She and her husband, they both got sick. She nastily sick relative to her lungs. You know, COVID's nasty. Get vaccinated. We all need to be vaccinated. All right. Now where am I? I'm going to tell you that the Doctor's Inn, oh, by the way, that's the end of the show. The Doctor's Inn is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Advantage Insurance Services. Independent insurance broker Dave Dalton can provide your insurance needs. Advantage Insurance is proud to support KZFR and can be reached at 342-0540. For a quote or more information, visit AdvantageInsuranceChico.com. BairdRoofingCompany.com. And by Baird Roofing Company, for a hole in your roof or a whole new roof. Baird Roofing Company has been serving Butte County for more than 30 years. Whether it's an existing structure or new construction, Baird Roofing has got you covered. More information at BairdRoofing.com, and Baird is B-A-I-R-D. So Baird, B-A-I-R-D, Roofing Co., company, C-O, .com, and can be reached at 342-1631. You need to know, including that bit I did on Cuba, the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. The next show is going to be Planetary Radio, and the next song you're going to hear here at the end of the show is called Dr. Wu by Steely Dan, and we're going to play that into the next show. But please listen again 1 month from today, the third Thursday of the month, for the Doctor's Inn, 6 to 7 in the evening. Here's Dr. Wu by Steely Dan.
Katie tried, I was halfway crucified, I was on the other side. Just when I'd spent the last piaster I could borrow. All night long, we would sing that stupid song. And every word we sang I knew was true. Are you with me, Dr. Wu? Are you really just a shadow?
Just a shadow of the man that I once knew. The long Venus drought ends now, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human